Good morning. It's 6 minutes after 9 o'clock. According to an article in the current issue of Foreign Policy magazine, foreign policy heavyweights on the left and right are calling for a new League of Democracies that could one day replace the United Nations. Senator John McCain has made it part of his platform.
We have to strengthen our global alliances as the core of a new global compact, a League of Democracies that can harness the vast influence of the more than 100 democratic nations around the world to advance our values and defend our shared interests.
But the author of the article titled A League of Their Own says that the plan rests on a false assumption. Thomas Carruthers is Vice President for Studies at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and he joins us by phone. Good morning, sir, and welcome to the program.
Good morning.
What is this so-called League of Democracies supposed to be?
Well, the idea really emerged after the Iraq War. A number of people were frustrated that the United States was unable to obtain permission from the United Nations for the Iraq War, and they thought, what about if there were a different forum with a smaller set of countries with whom we got along better, and we could go to them and legitimate international interventions by asking them for permission? So the idea started as a kind of an alternative forum of like-minded countries through which we could legitimate our international interventions. Then Senator McCain and I think some of his advisors got interested in the idea and said, we could do more than that. We could make this really the way the United States operates in the world, in a sense the forum through which we exercise a lot of our power. We could do it economically, in our humanitarian interests, in our drive to promote democracy. And a League of Democracies could really become an alternative forum to the United Nations, which the United States uses for all kinds of things. So it's really grown as an idea, and Senator McCain has come back to it several different times and really seems to have enthusiasm for it.
Well, this you point out in your article that this idea has been put forward by a bipartisan collection of foreign policy experts in the United States, and given the polarization that we've seen in the last few years, that's rather unique.
It is. I mean, the democracy promotion subject has long been an area of bipartisan consensus in which you'll find Republicans and Democrats agreeing on, hey, this is a good thing that the United States promotes democracy in the world. And I think the League of Democracies, the idea grows out of that consensus. And so you do have people on both sides of the political aisle. In fact, the original promoters of the idea were Democrats, but then I could say it's been taken up more by the Republican camp in the last year. But this reflects that democracy promotion, rightly so, I think, is something that attracts people from both parties. But this idea, in my opinion, is an extension of certain good ideas about democracy promotion, an extension that I think is a little bit troubling and would probably lead us down a wrong, kind of a wrong road diplomatically.
Well, let's expand on that. What's wrong with this idea?
Well, there are a couple problems. I mean, the first is that the idea that, hey, you're a democracy, we're a democracy, we ought to be able to work together on foreign policy sounds very appealing. You say, Great Britain and the United States, we work together really well. That's true, but if you start putting together all of the democracies around the world, what you find is a lot of them are countries or governments with which we don't get along so well in many ways. And in recent years, the number of countries that are democracies, but which we really don't see eye to eye, are increasing. I mean, Argentina is one good example. Nicaragua is now run by Daniel Ortega, the old Sandinista, who was elected. He's a Democrat, yet the idea that Daniel Ortega and John McCain are going to sit down and say, hey, we have a common vision for the world, doesn't really wash. And as the countries accumulate that are democracies that don't see eye to eye with us, you put yourself in a hard position. Either you form a league and include all of those countries and say all democracies invited, and then you have a bunch of countries that actually don't share a common vision. Or what you say is, no, you know what, we're only going to invite democracies that we basically get along with. And then people say, is this really a League of Democracies, or is this just a League of American Buddies? And you undercut the legitimacy of it. So first problem is, don't really have the shared interests. Second problem is, the world at this point, after President Bush's use of democracy promotion to justify the war in Iraq, to justify aspects of the war on terrorism that the world hasn't really liked so much, the world's pretty tired of associating U.S. power with democracy promotion. They're like, we like democracy, but we don't like this idea that it's all about the extension of U.S. power. And for a new president come to the world, a world which is really waiting for a turning of a page and some fresh ideas, say, I know, let's closely associate American power with this thing called the League of Democracies, really is tone deaf to the way the world has been sensitized to this topic. We really don't want to redouble our emphasis on the connection between American power and democracy promotion. If anything, we'll kind of back away a little bit easy and say, hey, democracy promotion is a shared value. It's not just something the United States wants. It's something that lots of countries ought to be able to work together on.
So I would infer from what you just said that this idea hasn't gained any traction in the international community.
I have seen, you know, I have watched carefully, and I have seen almost no expressions of support for this overseas. And I've also traveled a lot in the last 6 months, been to Europe in particular, talked with diplomats in a number of European countries. And when I mention the idea, they just roll their eyes and say, what is it with you people in Washington? Don't you understand, as one person put it to me recently, that the democracy promotion has become a punchline for bad jokes about the United States these days? And he showed me a bumper sticker, which is popular in Europe, produced here in the United States, but they've got it over there. And it says, be nice to me or I'll bring democracy to your country. And they say, that's democracy promotion. That's the unfortunate punchline. And so when you mention this idea, like I say, they roll their eyes and say, can we do this in a quieter way? Do you have to come forward with a big sort of league and try to associate everyone with the United States? So we're not finding much response overseas. And I'd say among sort of policy writers and policymakers in a number of capitals, they've quietly kind of said, let's just not go this way. But they don't tend to want to do that too publicly because they don't really want to spit in the face of a potential new U.S. president who's got an idea he's excited with. So they tend to just sort of quietly say, not interested, thanks.
Well, let's go back to the beginning of this. Now, this idea, supposed as you say, came about because people were frustrated with the fact that the United Nations didn't give us permission to go into Iraq initially. Okay, so absent that, all right, there are some people who have promoted this idea who have big problems with the UN for a lot of other reasons, mm-hmm. including one person whom you quote in your article is saying, what I like about it, it's got a hidden agenda. It looks as if it's all about listening and joining with allies, all that kind of stuff. You'd hear John Kerry say, except that the idea here, which McCain can't say, but I can, is to essentially kill the United Nations.
Yeah, that was Charles Krauthammer, a prominent commentator here in Washington, writing about it. Yeah, look, there's been an undertone to a lot of this, which is, you know what, the United Nations is just a series of headaches for the United States. Let's just create an alternative forum and gradually shift our interest and attention to that, and this other thing can atrophy. That's a non-starter with most governments in the world. They recognize the problems with the United Nations, but they say we need an all-inclusive organization to deal with the world's problems. And if the United States is going to start cherry-picking and saying, no, only these countries in our organization, they're not interested in joining up. Because that's another problem I didn't have a chance to get to with the League of Democracies, is that a lot of the most pressing problems in the world are ones that intrinsically you need non-democracies to participate in the solutions for. Look at global climate change. Who's an enormous producer of greenhouse gases? China. Why would you want a League of Democracies to sit down and try to tackle global climate change? You want China in on this process. That's the advantage of the United Nations, problematic though it is. You can think of lots of other problems. Darfur, people dying in that extraordinarily unfortunate situation in Africa. Who's crucial to solving that? China. Again, they've got to be part of the deal. They've got to be part of the negotiations, part of the process of bringing it together. If you create a league that excludes Russia, excludes China, excludes Saudi Arabia, excludes other countries that have a lot of weight on the international scene, and then say, now we want to solve the world's problems with this organization, the excluded countries are not going to feel good about working together with this organization, and you're not going to have within the boundaries of your organization all the players you need.
Well, and I would think that the countries that were excluded it seems to me like you're looking at a potential for reviving the Cold War.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because one of the things John McCain mentions is he says, you know, he harks back to NATO and the Cold War and says this is how we can rebuild the democratic solidarity that we had during the Cold War, to which one wants to say, but we're not in the Cold War anymore, are we? And, I mean, you look at, you know, the tendencies with the G8, this summit meeting that takes place every year with the leaders of 8 of the most powerful countries in the world, the tendency really is to try to expand it a bit, but to, you know, include Russia, which is part of the G8, to talk about maybe including China and others. And we've got some fora like that where we include countries like Russia and China, try to work together with them. Why do we need to go and create an alternative forum with which they'd be formally excluded? Their noses would be bent out of joint as a result, and they'd feel like, hey, we're being ganged up on. You want to be ideological? Well, we'll be ideological too back. So in that sense, I don't think it's a useful approach either.
The in the United States, in 2008, who besides the McCain campaign is taking this idea seriously?
Well, McCain camp is big. It's the Republican Party. Now, not all of the Republican Party has joined onto this idea because the Republican, I'd say, foreign policy establishment is unusually divided this year between the kind of traditional realists and the James Baker, Brent Scowcroft camp, and then the more sort of conservative idealists, more of the Bush people who like this idea. So McCain camp is divided. I'd say the Democratic camp is uncertain about this. On the one hand, it's a little bit hard to be against the League of Democracies openly because people say to you, oh, so you're not for democracy and not for promoting democracy. And it's a little hard for a candidate to stand up and say, I think this is a bad idea, because the answer is too long for the kind of sloganeering that goes on. And it's easy for an opponent to turn and say, well, I have good ideas for promoting democracy. You just seem to be against it. So neither Hillary Clinton during the primary season nor Barack Obama came out and spoke about this idea directly. And I don't think, as far as I know, Barack Obama has since. And I think his advisors are being cautious about not necessarily going on record of criticizing it, but not bringing it up and not supporting it. So, but nevertheless, there are other Democrats within sort of the foreign policy establishment, if you will, who do believe in the idea and who are working on it. And I quote some of those in the article and in other writings I've done.
You mentioned that that the Democrats have kind of left this alone because the response to it, it would be too long. Wouldn't you be able to attack this on the basis of the fact that it's simplistic?
Yeah, but simplistic sells well in politics. You know, let's face it, unfortunately, and it sounds like a rousing idea. And to come back, people would say, well, what's your alternative? And if you say, well, my alternative is to try to work in an existing fora like the United Nations, like the Organization of American States, that requires a certain courage to stand up and say, you know, I actually happen to believe in the United Nations and think it's a good thing, because the organization has been so trampled upon, in some ways deservedly, in some ways not, that it's surprisingly hard for people to say, I happen to believe that this is a forum worth working in. I think that's a regrettable state of affairs, but that's a bit the fact.
We're talking about the so-called League of Democracies, a proposal that has been embraced by the McCain campaign, although it started out originally developed by some moderate Democrats. And we'll find out what you want to think on the other side of want to say about it on the other side of this break. Here are the phone numbers to call to be involved in the program this morning: 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655, that's toll-free. If you're calling us from Milwaukee, the number is 414-227-2050, 227-2050. And as always, our email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn today. You're tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 20 after 9. You're tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today. Well, here's what's coming up a little bit later on in the day on the Ideas Network. Delicious, lethal, hallucinogenic, and medicinal fruits have led nations to war, fueled dictatorships, and lured people into new worlds. After 3 on Here on Earth, join Jean Faraca and her guest for an expedition through the fascinating world of fruit. That's coming up later today here on the Ideas Network. This hour, we're talking about the League of Democracies proposal, which has become a key component of John McCain's foreign policy platform and is somewhat controversial in some circles. And as we've heard our guests say, not being wildly embraced overseas, but certainly is getting some discussion here in the United States. And the genesis for this program was an article that appears in the current issue of Foreign Policy Magazine, and my guest is the author of that article, Thomas Carruthers. He's Vice President for Studies at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and he's on the phone with us. And a number of other people are on the phone as well, so let's go to the phones and take some calls. First, let's go to Sam in Madison. Sam, good morning, and thanks for joining us.
Hi, good morning. I'm listening to your show. It's pretty interesting that there is this new idea called the League of Democracies. But I have been following things for the past 7 years, and I can safely say that this new idea is basically a GARP to undermine the UN. And it's unfortunate that the word democracy has been so misrepresented by the U.S. I mean, democracy, the way U.S. practices it, is so different than the actual ideal term of what a democracy should be. So it's interesting that your guest speaker says that it's very difficult for democracies to get along, and that's exactly what it should be. Democracies should have arguments, should have differences, but you work through those differences. To create a new league of democracies just to have bosom buddies to invade the nations to serve the immediate needs of certain nations like the U.S. invading Iraq is ridiculous. It's really ridiculous that, and since it's coming from the Republican Party, it doesn't surprise me. I'm sure there are larger corporations that has played into this idea, and I'm not surprised that the John McCain as a candidate is supporting this idea, because it's not about democracy. It's about aggressive capitalism and increasing global markets for goods and products, and that's okay. But in the next 30 years, the actual democracies, the larger democracies of the world, would be on the other side. They would be with the UN. They would not be with the League of Democracies.
Thanks for the call, Mr. Crothers.
Well, one of the things that's interesting about what's happening in the world is, as democracy has spread in the last 30 years, is you just have a lot more variations in democracy, which, as the caller said, is natural and in some ways is a good thing. We now have, you know, countries like India, for example, a robust democracy, but just so different in many ways than the United States. And you have countries looking at U.S. democracy and saying, we really admire your country in many ways, but, you know, there are features of your democracy that we're not so crazy about, like low electoral turnout, the dominance of money in politics, the weakness of your political parties. And so there's an interesting democracy discussion going on in the world. And I think that's a good thing. But the United States sometimes still tends to act as though we're the city on the hill and the rest of the world is standing in admiration of our democracy, saying we'd like to be like you.
Or should be.
If they're not, then they're not sufficiently informed, and we need more public diplomacy to tell them about just the marvels of American democracy. And unfortunately, in fact, American democracy is more critically seen. And I think that's fine. I mean, we need to criticize our own democracy and find ways to improve it. And the League of Democracies, in some sense, represents, I'd say, an older school of thought, although it could be a forum for democracies to get together and discuss and that. But when it's put forward politically here in Washington, it's much more as an effort by the United States to organize a sort of a group of countries around it that the United States leads, which is not really what other countries, in most cases, are looking for from the United States.
In other words, what we're really looking for is a friendly room.
Exactly, yeah. And that's why certain countries we would feel very uncomfortable about having in the league. You see, it's interesting with Zimbabwe recently. The United States has been pushing on Zimbabwe, and I'm glad it has, because the Zimbabwean government has been doing horrific and horrendous things. But what's interesting is another democracy, which we hail as a very successful democracy, South Africa, has not been going together with us on that. And South Africa, unfortunately, doesn't happen to believe in pressuring Zimbabwe very hard. And that's another example, is if Zimbabwe were in the League of Democracies, which it should, if it's going to be a real League of Democracies, it would not work together with the United States on promoting democracy in Zimbabwe. It's another example of genuine democracies can have deep differences of opinion about foreign policy.
Let's go next to Don in Milwaukee. Don, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, and I agree, and this is a great program. My point, and it's somewhat repetitious, but we got to learn from the past, and not if we don't learn from the past, we're condemned to repeat it. And the League of Nations fell apart because the United States was not part of it, and you could argue that we got into the Second World War in part due to the fact that we didn't support the League. The United Nations is our best hope for a united nations of the world and not an extension of U.S. power, or, you know, the bumper sticker is absolutely right, that we need to have the United States be a part of the world and not the almighty power in the world, bully power, bullying others around. And we have to learn that. So we need to have the United Nations to promote it, to support it, and not to have it go the way of the League of Nations.
Don, thanks for that. So would you say, Don, that we just need, in the United States, we just need to get over ourselves?
Very much so, and start listening to, well, besides public radio, the BBC and other sources of international news that we can get, because we're not on the same page. We're not even in the same newspaper as the rest of the world.
One of the things that's interesting is when a new president is elected this fall and then comes into office early next year, the world is going to be waiting with a tremendous amount of anticipation and interest to see if the United States can, in a sense, get back on track with the rest of the world. There's a really a deep sense in many other societies that the United States has become disconnected from the world in a troubling way. And they don't want that. They would like to see the United States in greater harmony with how the rest of the world thinks about issues like climate change, for example, and certain kinds of human rights treaties and other things. And the new president will really have it, whether it's Barack Obama or John McCain, will have a real opportunity to turn to the world and say, you know, we are going to listen now. We are going to try to harmonize better and be a better global partner. And so it's going to be really crucial in the first several months of next year that the new president come forward with both some statements and some ideas that speak to that, really, I would have to say, a yearning on the part of the world to see the United States be a more effective and cooperative global partner. And that's where I'm concerned about this idea. I don't think this is a malicious idea necessarily, the League of Democracies. Some people want to destroy the UN who are behind it, but others are really just trying to look for a way to create a better forum. But I think it will be perceived by the world as, oh, no, you know, it's more of play by our, you know, our way, or we're going to take our marbles and go somewhere else. So I think it's really important that we put this idea aside and think about other ways a new president, Democratic or Republican, can speak to the world in a way that will really resonate and correspond with what the world would like to see from the United States.
I want to go back and pick up on something that was kind of a, I don't know, maybe it was a throwaway at the end of Don's comment there. He talked about not being in the same newspapers as the rest of the world. And I have to say that one of the things I started doing personally about the time of the whole blow-up in the Balkans in the 90s was to go online and read some of what was in the newspapers from other countries about the same things that were going on. And wow, I got a real wake up in terms of what people outside the United States thought about the world and compared it to what we got in the media. How informed is the average person about what the rest of the world thinks? Well, let me just start with that. How informed are we about what the rest of the world thinks of us?
One of the puzzling characteristics of the last 20 years is that our country, the United States, has been the engine of globalization in many ways, through a whole host of things that we've done culturally, politically, economically, technologically, and so forth. Yet, even though we're a force for globalization in the world, we're very much an outward radiating force in which we affect a lot of other countries and societies, whether we sell them iPods or set up McDonald's or send capital flows and so forth. But one of the things that's been striking in this process of globalization is we're still a very provincial society in many ways. We're very much a large island, which has its own norms and its own ways of doing things that projects out in the world but doesn't take very much in from the world in many ways. Now, of course, we take a lot of immigrants, but we hope these immigrants socialize quickly into American ways. But when you look at the sources of information that Americans turn to, newspapers and radio and television, very much American. When you look at the movies that we watch, 99% American. When you look at the books that we read, very few translated novels, and so forth. And we're just an unusual society. We're big enough and powerful enough to live within our own cultural world. And this creates a bit of a bubble syndrome in which we live within this bubble. It's a benign and benevolent bubble in certain ways to ourselves. And we really have a hard time understanding very basic things about how the rest of the world sees us and sees other issues that we care about. And I think it's characteristic of large societies. I've traveled a fair amount in Russia, for example. China, Brazil, and other large societies also tend to live within their own bubble. So we're not the only ones. But we're unusual. The contrast between the breadth of our power and the magnification of our influence in the world versus how much we understand the world on its own terms and take it in is really startling.
And does that explain why the "they hate our freedoms" argument has worked so well?
I think so. I mean, it's the "they hate our freedoms" is a good way of saying I mean, it's a deft or clever way of trying to combat the idea that we might be doing things that actually irritate people in the world and say, it's because we're so great that people don't like us. You know, it's just the curse of being great is that people don't like you. Whereas if you say, well, actually people have been angry about this particular policy in the Middle East or this you did in Afghanistan or this we did elsewhere, you say, oh, wait a minute, you're saying some of this might actually have something to do with what we've done. That's a lot more troubling to Americans. And so the whole debate over the war on terrorism has been characterized, at least from the administration's point of view, as it's because we're so wonderful that we're being attacked, as opposed to, some people are angry. And they might be angry about certain legitimate things, and that even their methods are totally illegitimate. But, you know, maybe we are actually provoking people in certain ways. I'm not saying that therefore terrorist attacks are justified. They're not, under any circumstances. But I'm saying if we want to understand and get into the roots of why 93% of people in Turkey are anti-American or have very negative views about the United States, well, we have to get inside their mind a little bit, inside their shoes, and think about why is that the case.
Let's take a call next from Jonathan in Milwaukee. Jonathan, thanks for joining us this morning.
Hi, thank you for having me, and thank you to your guest. I actually am a student at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and I spent a summer at the UN recently. And I just have to say that I think, first of all, I just want to make the point that this is just another ploy, in my opinion, by, you know, John McCain's campaign to, you know, basically have a, you know, quick solution that, you know, kind of looks good on the surface, but it doesn't really answer any questions, just like the gas, you know, But the second point I want to make is that this is kind of one of the fundamental things about the United Nations is that the more countries it includes, the more effective it can be in incorporating, you know, this kind of globalization idea and getting more people into the, you know, quote-unquote world community. And by doing so, you're going to include a lot of, you know, anti-democratic countries. But the thing that people don't realize is that a lot of the problems with the UN is it's not necessarily just the UN, but it's a reflection of the world in general. But the other thing to keep in mind is that the world in general is also getting better much quicker now than it ever has been before, and it's becoming more democratic, and societies are becoming freer and more open with access to the Internet and blogs and, you know, more travel, etc. So this kind of infrastructure, while right now has a lot of problems, is improving, and over the next 10 or 20 years is important to include the inclusivity and maintain that as opposed to, you know, developing a new kind of exclusive, quote-unquote, like, league of democracies where, you know, certain countries are going to, you know, get merit-based priority membership or whatever, you know, they're proposing. So quickly to summarize, this is simply, you know, another political ploy to gain, you know, favor because they're grasping at straws right now due to a losing campaign. And I think that the United Nations, while has a lot of problems, is certainly important and will become more so in the next 20 years. Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling in, Jonathan. Appreciate it. Mr. Crothers?
I think one of the important things to see about the United Nations is that with the problems before us, the United Nations is going to be really challenged. I mean, all countries are, let's take global climate change, all countries are deeply challenged by global climate change. It's a very slowly unfolding problem, so therefore it's easy to ignore. It requires real sacrifice. So you require sacrifice now with no immediate payoff. It requires countries to harmonize their sacrifices and actually band together and work on it, and so forth. And so a problem like that, you could say, well, the UN is incapable of handling it. Well, who is capable of handling it? You know, you have to have all of these countries on board, or at least the major emitters on board, to work on it. And I think what we're going to see, in a way, the problems of the world are going to force international organizations like the United Nations to up their game. Because they're not going to have any choice, or we're going to all sink together. And so I think the United Nations, problematic though it's been, and goodness knows it's a complicated and difficult and troubled organization, we've got to stick with it. We've got to figure out ways to create sometimes specialized fora that would tackle a problem like global climate change and feed into the United Nations, but maybe not rely on particular existing mechanisms, sometimes special commissions that are formed and so forth. But the principle throughout it has to be inclusivity as much as possible, a spirit of feeding into the UN project rather than feeding away from it and so forth.
Bill in Hortonville is up next. Bill, good morning.
Good morning, sir. I think what this relates to primarily is one world government, with the United States being that government. and I was concerned very much as to how this relates to the Trilateral Commission.
Well, I think that the impulse is in some ways a bit different from one world government, because the people who I think are behind the League of Democracies are people who are suspicious of world government, which they see as emanating from, you know, people who really believe in the United Nations. And they say the League of Democracies is a way to create an international organization that's very much friendly to the United States, in which we don't have countries in it whom we don't agree with, and so forth. So there may be a similar impulse in the sense that Americans tend to think big and think about, you know, how can we project our power out into international organizations and band together. But this is a different project from those people who might say, gee, I believe in world federalism or world government. That's kind of a different club.
Is there a lot of talk about world federalism? I mean, you really don't hear about it that much.
I think it's an idea that's largely faded away. And I think that at least what I see the contending sides here in Washington, you know, in this campaign and more broadly, you know, they're concerned about multilateralism versus unilateralism. They're concerned about the effectiveness of the United Nations. They wonder if new regional organizations can be important and so forth. But the old idea, the world, sort of world federalism, world government and so forth, that there'll really be a single sort of, you know, unified council running the world and so forth, is kind of something that's faded away and looks a little bit like those kind of old science fiction movies where you see a really futuristic rocket and then you look closely at it and realize it's, you know, made up of tinfoil.
You know, discussions of unilateralism are not really new. I seem to recall that the high school debate topic in 1968 concerned unilateral military intervention. And I know that because I was a high school debater at that time, which kind of gives away how old I might be. But, you know, the criticism of countries acting unilaterally isn't anything new in the modern era of foreign policy. This debate is still going on.
It is. It's a recurrent theme in U.S. foreign policy. It's kind of, you know, the United States foreign policy is marked by a number of themes which run through, you know, the 20th century and even back in the 19th century. One of them is sort of realism versus idealism. How much do we incorporate our ideals into policy? How much do we just follow a narrower set of realistic interests? Another, as you say, is unilateralism versus multilateralism. Do we really work together with others? Should we lead? And so forth. Another is kind of isolationism versus expansiveness, projecting ourselves outward. And these are just themes which we're going to come back to time and time again. They're sort of broader choices that our country faces that are not going to go away. They simply update to new contexts that emerge.
Let me give the phone numbers again, because we do have some phone lines that have now opened up, and you can reach us to have a discussion about this topic. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. It's a toll-free number. If you're calling us from Milwaukee, it's a local call for you, so give us a ring at 414-227-2050, 227-2050. And as always, our email address is talk@wpr.org. My guest this hour is Thomas Carruthers, Vice President for Studies at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and he is the author of an article in the current issue of Foreign Policy magazine titled A League of Their Own. It's about the proposed League of Democracies that has become a key piece of the John McCain campaign's foreign policy. I think we can take a break now. We'll take a break and we'll come back and we'll take some more phone calls. Again, a line is open for you if you want to call in right now at 800-486-8655 or 227-2050. I'm John Munson, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 9:42. You're tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn today. Here's what's coming up next hour. After 10, I'll be talking with Kevin McKinley, a financial planner, about how to survive tough economic times with strategies to protect and grow your net worth. I could use some of that. Net worth, that is. That's after 10 this morning here on the Ideas Network. This hour we're talking about foreign policy, and specifically the proposal that is being touted by the McCain campaign of a League of Democracies. We have with us the author of an article about that idea, which appears in the current issue of Foreign Policy magazine. Thomas Cruthers is Vice President for Studies at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. We have full phone banks, so let's go back to the phones and talk next to Victor in Milwaukee. Victor, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning to your guests. I have reservations about this because often we forget about the complexities in each of those countries, say like we do have a League of Democracies. Case in point, United States gets a Republican president and he's against abortion. And a lot of nations that are democracies support abortion rights. Or if we get a Democratic president who may be against the death penalty, we got democracies who have death penalty as their form of capital punishment. So, you know, it may not work because we don't want to touch those countries with those domestic policies with a 10-foot pole. The other problem I have is the United States has a lot of hypocrisies as far as domestic policies, particularly in the form of dissent. Another case in point, when France did not want to support us during the Iraq invasion, here we are, Americans, who wanted to isolate them, insult the French, and we had Americans that were pouring French wine, you know, down the drain. And can we handle, we have the maturity of handling dissent.
It's some very good observations there. I mean, one of the things that's striking when you turn to the social front is that the United States is kind of an outlier on a number of social issues compared to other democracies. Take the death penalty. If you talk about the death penalty in European circles, democratic European circles, people are really sort of shocked that the United States still practices the death penalty. And if you wanted to put together a league of countries with which the United States is harmonious with respect to the death penalty, it wouldn't include any other democracies. It would include China, for example, which is another big practitioner of the death penalty. The same is true with our general approach to prisons and prison population. The United States has the highest rate of incarceration in the world. The only countries, again, that are even close are non-democracies, again, like China. And so what's puzzling in a way is that, you know, by saying a league of democracies, we're implying a common set of values, whereas I was saying before, a lot is under discussion now in democracies. The United States is kind of out on one end on many social issues. Now, you could say, well, look, this is a foreign policy venture. We're really just talking about how harmonious would we be and consistent with other democracies on foreign policy issues, not things like that. But these days, there's a constant bleeding across the line between domestic issues and foreign policy issues. So the caller mentioned, Victor mentioned, for example, abortion. The United States has turned abortion into a foreign policy issue because in our foreign aid, we're unable to give certain kinds of assistance to organizations abroad that might support abortion for local populations and so forth. So social issues do end up bleeding into foreign policy issues. And the lack of commonality between many of the social elements of American society today with regard to other democracies would end up being another element of divisiveness in how the United States does or does not get along with other democracies on foreign policy issues.
The late mass communication theorist Marshall McLuhan talked about how we are always living in the rearview mirror. The United States didn't really become a major foreign policy player or a real leader until World War II and the aftermath of World War II. Are we still living in the glow of the triumphalism at the end of World War II?
Well, you're certainly right that the 20th century was the story of America's emergence as a global power, and the biggest chapter where we walked through the doors onto the world stage was really World War II. And it's also true that we formed a set of assumptions in those years about America's place in the world and America's relative power that now, 50 years later, we're really having to take a second look at. And there's been a spate of books in the last year or two about America's position in the world. And I think the theme of some of them, and some of the very thoughtful ones, is that, you know, the world is just fundamentally different than it was then. And one of the ways in which it's fundamentally different is the United States, in relative terms, is now facing a world of, you know, contending powers of different types. American power is not as relatively great as it once was. And also, the United States is not necessarily the country to which lots of people around the world are looking to as a model, and they have other ways of doing things. And so countries are positioning themselves in the world. You take a country like Argentina, they say, hey, got an important trade relationship with China. We need to maintain that, also with Japan in certain ways. We need to be friendly with the United States, big neighbor to the north, but we're also developing our relationship with Brazil, which is very important to us, and then with Europe. And so we have a multifaceted game. We're not looking for a world in which there's the big leader out there, the United States. It's a complicated. It's a mosaic now, the world. We've been seeing this emergence of multipolarism for a generation now, but it's really starting to take effect.
We'll go back to the phones and take a call next from Jim in Salt Lake City.
Hi, thanks, John. Hey, I'd like to ask your guest, what is the origin or who is credited for, I don't know, so much distrust in the UN? I mean, did it happen right after World War II? Because in the West, you hear people saying, we got to stay away, we got to get out because you're going to control our troops and take our Americans and put them in the world court and we'll have no constitutional freedom, and there's all this fear about the UN. Like, who started this, and what is this fear based on?
Excellent question. I mean, I think skepticism about the UN really emerged in the 1960s, and it had two different bases. One was the fact that because of the divide between the Soviet Union and the United States during the Cold War, it was impossible to get anything done in the Security Council in serious terms because the two countries, the two major superpowers, simply couldn't agree. So the United States got very frustrated with the UN and felt that the hopes of the late 1940s in terms of having the Security Council be the kind of forum that could really decisively act on international issues was not coming to pass. At the same time, secondly, in a different phenomenon, but in the same years in the 1960s, the kind of non-aligned movement, the fact that there was a whole set of countries in the world that were really trying to stay out of the contest between the Soviet Union and the United States and began to act together as a bloc in the General Assembly of the UN, and many of these countries were very critical of the United States, whether it was Egypt or India or Indonesia or Mexico or others, began to irritate the United States. The United States began to feel like, why are we getting all this flack from in the General Assembly, and these resolutions are being passed about Israel that we don't agree with, they're being passed about human rights situations in other countries that we think is ridiculous, and this sort of irritation over the, what the United States viewed as this kind of noise coming from all of these other countries in the UN led to disillusionment as well, and particularly the issue of Israel, the treatment of Israel by many other countries in the world really angered the United States and some of the resolutions that were passed. So Daniel Patrick Moynihan, when he was the ambassador to the United Nations, and he wrote this book about the experience, and I think it was in the early 70s, really captured the sense of American frustration. So it was both about the divisiveness of the UN at the top level between the Soviet Union and the United States, and this other phenomenon of many other countries kind of spitting on the United States in small ways in the General Assembly. So it was in the 1960s, and that really has colored two generations now of American foreign policy specialists who, since that time, have had a great deal of skepticism about the UN.
Well, and I think the Jim's point about some of the fears that people have, there are some things projected on the UN that really aren't part of the United Nations. The World Court really isn't a UN organization, is it? That's a separate entity.
You're right. There are some institutions like the International Court of Justice that are, in a broad sense, carried out under international treaties which may have been concluded in relationship to certain UN instruments that have also frustrated people. But I think, actually, the International Court of Justice has been less a source of disillusionment or frustration than the General Assembly of the United Nations and the Security Council and the unwillingness to act. And then remember the battles over UN institutions like UNESCO and the cultural policies of UNESCO, which people felt were objectionable, leading, and I think it was in the 1970s, I may not be right about that, the United States to withdraw from UNESCO and only return years later because they felt there were offensive sort of international cultural policies and so forth. So it was really the core UN institutions that were bothering the United States rather than some of the ones that you mentioned, like the International Court of Justice, that were sort of outside the immediate circle of those UN institutions.
But I guess what I was getting at is there seems to be a residual fear of other organizations controlling what the United States does or telling us what to do and being able to make it stick.
Absolutely. I mean, again, a long-running theme in American foreign policy really for more than 100 years is we do not want people, governments, other countries telling us what to do and exerting authority over us. And the kind of arrangements that European Union countries now have in Europe, in which a lot of their national legislation is subject to judicial review by European institutions, harmonization of their national laws with those of other countries and so forth, is unthinkable to the United States. Here we have a very, you know, strong view of our own sovereignty. We don't want other people telling us what to do. And as a result, the UN is part of a much broader syndrome where we feel like the world is pressing in and saying, you know, trying to criticize us in different ways, and we don't want the authority of others over us. Again, that's a bit of the island syndrome that I talked about before. I think large countries that live off by themselves tend to develop this sort of very tough view about sovereignty, whereas smaller countries like, you know, the Netherlands, that are pocketed right in the midst of, you know, an intense set of other countries with which it's relating to constantly, tend to develop a more relational and a more flexible approach to sovereignty.
Let's go next to Marty in Milwaukee. Marty, good morning.
Yes, good morning, John and Thomas. Thanks for letting me join you here. I have a question. I hope you didn't address it in the first 10 minutes, because that's when I joined the show. I'm wondering, in terms of this whole idea, who decides what a democracy is? What are the criteria, and who makes the decision? I mean, Zimbabwe just had its third or fourth election before Robert Mugabe was finally satisfied with the results. I mean, so I guess I'm wondering, how the heck do you would this run, and who would admit, who would be in charge of the gate? Who would be the gatekeeper?
That's an excellent issue, and we didn't get to that before, but you know, it would be difficult in setting up a League of Democracies to agree on criteria, because countries do disagree about what's a democracy and what's not. Russia happens to feel that they're a democracy. They call it sovereign democracy, and they talk about themselves as a democratic country. Others would say Russia falls short on basic democratic criteria. Now, I think it's possible generally to come up with a definition of democracy that has credibility and has legitimacy, definition that centers around elections plus participatory political and civil rights. But applying that very specifically to some countries that really sort of fall in the gray zone between democracy and dictatorship is a very political determination. It seems very likely, and we see this from the experience of something called the Community of Democracies, which was in fact set up at the U.S. initiative in the year 2000, intended to be an association of democracies. It's a kind of forerunner of the League of Democracies. And the Community of Democracies has had to spend almost 10 years arguing about who gets invited and who doesn't. Should Russia be in the Community of Democracies? Should Russia be kicked out when it moves backwards? Should Egypt be invited? Should Jordan be invited? Should Morocco be invited? And so forth. And so that has been a headache in terms of agreeing on it. And basically, you end up falling back to the old principle in life of, you know, whoever has the gold makes the rules. I mean, whoever's organized the league and whoever is powerful and in control of it ends up making the decisions about who's a democracy or not. And that usually doesn't command much credibility among other countries that are excluded and say, yeah, well, you apply your rules one way to me, but do you apply them to your friends differently?
And we'll go next to Marion in Nina, who's been holding for a while. Marion, thanks for hanging in there.
Good morning, Tom. Good morning, John. Listening to the show, and, you know, while I'm waiting here, there's been some commentary that might have changed, you know, exactly what the questions I was going to pose, at least to some degree. What I was going to ask is, you had an earlier caller that talked about the League of Nations and, you know, how that somehow, I think the caller was making the assumption that led us into World War II. And then after, obviously, with the United Nations, our participation in it and how that fell apart, like you guys discussed in the 60s. But with Lend-Lease and everything, we can play this gray area. And even though we're part of the United Nations, you know, we can kind of parlay what we're going to do, whether within it or without it, especially what happened with Iraq. Here's my question for you, and I hope this isn't too lengthy. You know, with everything being complicated and it, the world being a global economy, how hard is it going to be for us to even make any, you know, attempts to have a good foreign policy when things are changing just constantly? You know, one day we have, you know, we're reliant on China for manufacturing. We've gone away from our own manufacturing. We know there's problems there, but we're not really making a lot of determinations on how to change that. So if you guys could just discuss that and how we fit in, you know, we are living in a turbulent world where there's a lot of changes, and some countries are going to go with us and with our foreign policy. And even within our country, right now going into election, we haven't determined, you know, which way everyone's going to go for the...
Okay,
you know,
Marion, thanks a lot. We've only got about a minute left, and I want to give our guest a chance to respond. I didn't mean to cut you off there, but Mr. Crothers, about 60 seconds from you, please.
it is a very relational world and a changing world these days in which the United States can't always just fall back on old lines and say, we've always done it this way, we've always had these friends, we've always had these enemies. Things are moving fast. China is in some ways our greatest strategic rival, or potential strategic rival, but it's also our biggest trading partner in many ways. And so you have a dual relationship with a country like China that's extremely complex. If China didn't buy all the treasury bonds that it buys, our currency might be in difficult shape. Yet at the same time, we look at the rise in the Chinese military spending and say, this could bode trouble for us. So we are facing a world of multiple actors which are changing their relative power relationships, which are having differentiated relationships with the United States. I think this calls for flexibility. It calls for, you know, leadership that really understands this and is willing to respond and tell the truth to the American people and not hand them simplistic slogans. And that's why this particular idea of the League of Democracies, I think, is a bit static, doesn't fit well with this changing reality, and is something we shouldn't move forward with, even though we should look for new policy ideas and sort of a new initiative for foreign policy under a next administration.
Well, I want to thank you for spending this hour with us. It's been very informative, and judging by the number of callers we had, people were pretty happy that we had this topic on the air today. So thank you for joining us.
John, it's been my pleasure.
Thomas Cruthers is Vice President for Studies at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and he wrote the article, A League of Their Own, in the current issue of Foreign Policy magazine. This program was produced by Rhonda Fanning with Kate Mattson handling on-air production this morning. If you'd like a copy of it, you can call the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program 711D. I'm John Munson, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn. Stay tuned, another hour of programming to come with me here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.